You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello, welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is the hardest working comic in Queensland, Australia, Lindsay Webb. Okay, so Lindsay Webb, we were in your car last night after a gig in
the Paddo
in Brisbane, the Sit Down Comedy Club. And when I got in it, I said to you, "This is a really big car. Are you on TV?" And I think you said you're not. You're one of those people who works. You managed to work hard enough to have a nice car without being on TV.
That's
so
right.
Tell me about that.
It's taken a while, to be honest with you, Stu. It's 15 years since I kicked off.
Okay.
8 years full time. And I won't lie to you, it's been hard. It's been difficult. Not being on telly, whilst I don't see it as a disability in terms of being a full-time comic, it does make it harder because you need to make yourself known to the public. Mm-hmm. You've got to do your own promotion and marketing. And I've been on the telly. I've had spots on the telly.
Sure.
But never enough to be that guy that's on that.
Yeah, okay.
You know, or that guy that regularly does that spot on that. You know, I've done bits and pieces like Good News Week and the footy show and the project. But it's always just one bit. You know, it's just that little feeder bit when someone else is not available.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So it has been hard work, but I love what I do, so putting more effort into it doesn't seem like much of a challenge.
And you work incredibly hard as well. I mean, we were just talking last night about you've come straight from doing a run at the Adelaide Fringe, during which you were also hosting late shows most nights.
That was massive.
It was huge. And then you had one day, a transit day, not even really a day off.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to you now at the Powerhouse venue in Brisbane where you're teaching a bunch of kids. You're doing everything. Anything you could possibly do with comedy, you seem to be doing.
I kind of see my career like Tetris, you know? If you can put enough blocks in the right places and line them up at the right time, then you'll make a wall of success. You know, that's just the way I look at it. And hopefully you don't line them up so that last year disappears.
Sure.
But it's a challenge, and it's a challenge that I like. And I guess for me it stays fresh by doing different stuff like today. You know, teaching young kids, like holding a workshop. Mm-hmm. And then the stage we're sitting on, I'm going to do a performance on in an hour for a bunch of hopeful 15, 16, 17-year-old kids that are interested in comedy.
Okay, you know? So you're doing a set for them?
I will host the competition afternoon. They come out, do their bits. I make sure the audience is nice and warm and they've got a platform that works for them. And to be honest, they're quietly shitting themselves in the rehearsal room. But, you know, I like being able to share what I've learnt in that 15 years. You know, I made a lot of mistakes early on and I didn't know who I was on stage and I didn't know what sort of character I wanted to be and really just blurted out a bunch of jokes that I thought were funny and nonsensical and got away with it to the point that I stuck around, you know.
Okay. Well, let's talk, before we go into any more detail, let's just sort of put you in context. How did you come to comedy? How did you approach it?
I got started from street theatre. Basically, that's probably the best way to look at it. I did characters in a theatre restaurant. And then got into street theatre. And I was doing the same thing that we all did when we were younger, TV ads and small bits in
theatre. Let's just pause a bit on street theatre. My routine, which I did used to do a circle show. What kind of street stuff are you doing? I have to say, I've never spoken to anyone that's done character restaurant before. How was that? Let's start with that.
That was fantastic because you get to hide behind a character, right? So I had full face makeup. You pick a character. I was an alcoholic chef. Okay. My name was ACE, which was an acronym, Alcoholic Chef Extraordinaire.
Yeah.
Basically, I played a drunk chef who took your orders at a table.
Okay.
For drinks, right?
And that's within someone's existing theatre restaurant.
That's right.
Company. It was a place you auditioned for the job? Or
it was not really an audition. You sort of got recommended for a job there.
Okay.
It was a place called Crazy's Comedy Restaurant in Brisbane.
Okay.
I think it ran for about 16 years,
okay,
until the year 2000 when they closed down. I got recommended for a job there from a cafe that I was working at. The guy, okay, that was the manager used to work there and said, you've got to go and work at this place.
Oh, my God. Okay. So you're a sufficiently funny waiter that,
yeah,
you should be in the comedy.
That's right.
You shouldn't be in this real restaurant.
No. You're making people too happy.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of here.
Awesome.
I saw the chef smile. Go away. So I got started from character waiting and then slipped into street characters. So not busking and not on the street trying to make money, actual corporate characters for the street.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it was actually born from a company in the UK called The Naturals.
Yeah, I know The Naturals, the Natural Theatre Company.
Well, The Natural Theatre Company had a sidearm that started in Australia called Is It Entertainment?
Okay.
Is It with an exclamation mark rather than being a question. The whole idea there was exactly like The Naturals, was to go out into public situations as characters but have people look at you going, is it?
Yes, sure, okay.
Is it a character? Or is that just an ordinary person that I find really strange?
Okay.
So there was a really good discipline in doing those characters. They were true to the script. When I say script, I don't mean, you know, we had to say exactly what they said, but they were true to character.
Yes, so gotcha.
There was a lot of rehearsal and time spent back of house making sure that those characters hit the street correctly.
Okay.
And at that point in my career, I was quite young in terms of performer and in age. I was like in my early 20s, I was doing street theatre. I was the only one in the troupe that wasn't traditionally and classically trained at some sort of university and had a degree in acting or performance of some description. But I had a natural ability that people went, we're just going to drag him along.
Great.
He fits in, he understands the work, he can do it, which I did. I always just grabbed a hold of it and went for it.
Okay.
Then in 98, I was encouraged to go in the stand-up comedy competition Raw here in Australia.
Okay, yeah.
Massive nationwide Triple J competition, and very fortunately won the state final and got hooked, as you do when you, I mean, if anyone that does 5 minutes of comedy on a stage anywhere and enjoys it is hooked. There is, I mean, if you have a good time, you'll go back.
So did you have any kind of comical leanings before that? Were you, I mean, how old were you when you did the theatre restaurant?
I was 21.
Okay, and had you ever 21. Done any sort of performing before then?
I had done performing. I did theatre sports all through school.
Okay.
So, you know, without going into too much detail, I had a troubled childhood.
Okay.
And performing was escapism for me.
Sure.
I could pretend to be someone else.
Sure.
When you pretend to be someone else, they don't have any of the troubles that you have in your life.
Okay, sure.
You can have fun.
Sure.
So I always have performed, you know, from about grade 7 or 8 in school.
I should say this podcast, I hope, is a place where if you want, you can go into detail of these things. I'm not pushing you to at all, but this is a platform if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, well, we can. I grew up not underprivileged, but certainly challenged in a social environment. I grew up on a farm.
Okay.
Not a remote farm, but a farm far enough away from the main city to be isolated. So it was a 45-minute drive into Canberra, the nation's capital here in Australia.
Okay.
And it was a poor time for farms. We're a sheep station, primarily a super fine wool sheep station. And during the 80s and early 90s, it was an absolute drought. So the money was terrible.
Okay.
You know, you're living in a family that has an amazing amount of assets, yet no cash.
Sure.
You find yourself at a private school being the poorest kid at a private school.
Okay.
Which, you know, at the private school I was at in Canberra was surrounded by politicians and lawyers and diplomats and international students. And there was a wealth of difference. You know, there was a whole heap of multicultural kids. And when you're the poorest, you stand out.
Yeah, right.
So in school, and a lot of people always go, oh, you know, were you the class clown? Were you the joker?
Sure.
I wasn't. I was the kid that was picked on the most.
Okay.
And what I developed out of that, instead of becoming downtrodden and disappointed in that, I developed a thick skin and started launching back.
Okay.
So I'd throw back funny lines to bullies. I'd try and bring them down with their own game. Didn't always work.
Okay.
But I had the confidence to do it, you know, just because I wasn't going to let them get under my skin. The reason for that is that not only did I live in a poor household when I was a kid, I lived in quite a violent household. My mum was terribly violent.
Sure.
And I guess by the time I got to boarding school, I was ready.
Yeah,
I was ready to be beaten down by these kids because my mum had done it in a house. Like it was all I really knew was being beaten down, right? So I reverted into myself. And then again in high school with the bullying and getting away from my mum, I started to find my own voice. I started to find my own action. And I thought, well, I quite like performing and threw myself at it. I did everything. I did Shakespeare. I did, you know, theatrical funny. I did, you know, poetry recital, Banjo Patterson stuff, like pretty much everything. I tried all of it so that I had an idea of what I liked.
Okay.
What I really liked was when people laughed. It seemed I was making people happy.
Sure.
And that made me happy.
Okay.
Bottom line, I found a place where I was happy in the world.
That gave you some sort of sense of identity.
Yeah, totally.
You'd previously been feeling like an outsider and now you felt like you knew what your thing
was.
Yeah.
So that kind of fed the fire. You know, that was fuel. Acting and performing was the fuel to my desire. And I decided, even younger than that, I wanted to perform. But I guess you make a solid decision in your teen years and go, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, you know?
Which is a big thing because clearly what you're sort of saying is, oh, I want to be famous.
Which,
which, you know, okay. is a pipe dream to every boy and every girl, you know. Do you want to be famous? Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone...
I think that's terrifying now. I'm sure I read somewhere where like a teacher in an article had said, the problem now is that you ask people what they want to do when they grow up.
Yeah.
They say, be famous.
Sure.
With no actual... Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not... Like, for you and me, we might have said, be famous at performing or something.
Absolutely, it has become diluted, hasn't it? Because there is so many ways you can be famous now. You know, the internet and TV news and all sorts of stuff will make you famous. So I enjoyed it and I decided to follow on. And as I've just talked about, I found a way to do that. It became a lot of fun for me.
Okay.
And I put all that behind me. I certainly don't dwell on any of that stuff. None of that stuff comes out in my shows.
Okay.
It has done. I did a show called Lad to Dad at the Edinburgh Festival in 2007.
Okay.
And it was kind of cathartic, to be honest. I kind of got all of that stuff off my chest.
Sure.
All of those things I was just talking to you about, I put into a show that was full of emotion. And
I was going
to
say, you seem like you've either undergone therapy or had some sort of cathartic experience where you're like, okay, I can put that in place. I know what that was.
Yeah, I did. I did this show, which, you know what Edinburgh's like, not that many people came to it. Mm-hmm. And I was doing shows each night to maybe 20 or 30. And I know that in terms of Edinburgh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, sure.
But over a month of having that every night, it's not a whole heap of people.
No.
But it was just enough people. It was enough people for me to not worry about the show being too small. I wasn't losing money. Certainly wasn't making a great deal of cash, I wasn't bleeding cash. So I could focus on the show. And the show was really different to any show I did before that or since.
Okay.
It had real emotion in it. It had real true stories. At one point at about... In an hour-long show, at the 35-minute mark, a percentage of the crowd would cry.
Okay.
There was a point in there with the content that I was delivering to the crowd and the way that I'd, you know, involved myself with them emotionally up until that point that they cried. They didn't like that information.
Yeah, okay.
But then bringing them back out of that and seeing people laugh and enjoy the story as it evolves kind of made me feel better. I was kind of like, yeah, you know what? At that point in my life, I cried too.
Yeah,
but
right.
I do feel better now, which is the way the audience feels, and I think, all right, well, let's just move on. Let's just put that in the past.
Lindsay never stops. He's a really hard worker, a real grafter, writes loads, gigs loads. As an MC in particular, he's got those power gears that can turn any room into a great gig. As you can hear from the show so far, he's got loads to say, so I'm going to shut up and let him say it. You can email me, as ever, your questions and suggestions for Aussie and Kiwi acts to interview at info@comedianscomedian.com. You can tweet me at ComComPod. And I'm sorry this one's gone out a little bit late. Next week, already in the can, I've got a brilliant interview with Clark McFarlane, a friend of mine and the alter ego of high-end cabaret clown Mario Queen of the Circus. You might have seen him in Le Clique or La Soiree. But don't panic. He's heard the Dr. Brown interview before we spoke, and he is much more appreciative of stand-up, so there's no need to email me regarding that. That's all for now. Having a great time here in Brisbane this week at the Sit Down Comedy Club, working with Lindsay. And so now, let's get back to Lindsay Webb.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Let's just go back to that journey of you did the theatre sports at school,
yep.
The restaurant, the street characters with mm-hmm. the naturals, and then you went on to do the competition. So when you entered Raw,
yep.
had you done gigs before, or was that your first time you stepped on
no.
stage?
No, it wasn't the first time I'd stepped on stage. About a month before the Raw competition, I got up in character at the theatre restaurant and did a 5-minute spot.
Okay.
But I did it as my character.
Okay.
Right, which I never did in the competition.
Sure.
It was merely a way of me presenting some material that I was protected from not being
yeah,
me.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. Good work.
And then the material worked, and I went, oh, well, scrub this makeup off. Let's get some jeans and a T-shirt. I'm into this.
So did you use the same or similar material?
Same material.
Okay, so what was that about? What was the stuff about?
Oh, mate, it was so basic. It was really simple.
Don't worry, I would be staggered if you said, you know what, it was bloody great. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was enjoyable. I started with a lot of impersonations. When I first started doing comedy, there was a lot of impersonations in there and a lot of whimsical jokes. My very first joke ever was about a bum bag, and I said, you know, I'm not very good at shopping. Bought myself one of those new Fandangle 5-pocket fake leather bum bags. Geez, they're hard to put in.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah.
You know, it's a pretty obvious joke. But,
sure.
But that was the start of my joke writing process. I was going through writing jokes about situations and situations I had, and some of them were just lame. Like, I had a throwaway one-liner that was, I got in this cab the other day and he said, where to? And I said, I don't care. Go off. Go rank. We just sat there. That were the kind of thoughts I'd had about comedy and about writing comedy. Basically throwing together one-liners and observations to try and put together a routine.
Sure.
I certainly didn't understand anything about through lines and arcs and really set up punch at that point.
So for you, it was a case of trying to say stuff that validated you being there.
Absolutely.
Just kind of give me some laughs and then I'll know that I'm supposed to be here.
Yeah, and I was so rigid at it that I would often, you know, and I've looked back and listened to some of the early stuff. You know, I refer to the audience as ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, sure.
You know, a lot of that sort of stuff.
Okay.
Like you're at a, you know, formal dinner for year 12 students.
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've got some entertainment for you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
You know, do you ever notice, ladies and gentlemen, that it's just constantly like,
classic.
Ladies and gentlemen, oh, folks, oh, people.
It's
constantly going, oh, there's people there, there's a crowd there. And that's that fear that you have when you first start. That's, you know, acknowledging that there's people there.
Okay. And how did that feel? Obviously, it felt great to win the competition.
Yeah, it was amazing. But
did you ever sense then of, I'm going to spend my life doing this?
To be honest, no.
Okay.
No, I didn't. And there's a couple of reasons probably when I think back to that time. The real reasons, I suppose, were that comedy wasn't massive in Australia then.
Sure.
And certainly not in Brisbane. Like, there was only one club. There was one place doing comedy, and that was it. If you're an open mic comic, pardon me, you basically had a spot on a Thursday or a Friday. There was one or two spots Thursday and Friday night for open mic, because that was it.
And were there a lot of people vying for those spots?
Yeah, probably a dozen or so, you know, even at that point. And now there's, like, up to 4 or 5 open mic rooms running in this city every week, like, full-time with up to 16 people each night in the show.
Okay.
And they're not even the same ones at the same shows. Like, there's the market has changed so much. So back then, I didn't really think that there was a future in being a full-time comedian.
Okay.
I thought that I'd probably be able to do some comedy all the way through my career. I didn't see it as a futuristic full-time thing. And the proof is in the pudding, where I didn't chase being a full-time comic straight off the top. Mm-hmm. I realised that I wasn't at the level of people that were there already. And at that point, there was people like Vince Sorrenti and Bruno Lucia, and they were the top of the pops. You know, that was who was really kicking it in Australia. So I decided that I wanted money. Mm-hmm. You know, as a young performer, I wanted to find an avenue where there was good money for performing.
Okay.
And I sniffed down the road of radio.
Okay.
And got an opportunity to write for a breakfast show here in Brisbane, Sammy and Dean on Triple M.
Okay.
So I was writing for the female co-host. I was writing jokes for her each morning out of the paper, which was a really interesting mindset, trying to write as a woman.
Okay.
You know, you're writing.
Well, tell me about that. What's that? I've never written for a specific person.
At that point in my career, I'd really only been writing jokes for myself for 2.5 to 3 years.
Okay. And these were these still the same sort of one-liner takeoff?
Similar, but more topical stuff out of the paper. Yeah, puns and one-liners and that sort of stuff, and suspension of disbelief, any of that sort of thing. But you have to then put. I was putting myself in the mindset of, you know, an early 30s woman. And I'm a mid-20s male at that point going, I don't even understand women. how do I write like one?
Okay.
However, I was there for probably 5 or 6 weeks just filling in for the full-time writer.
Sure.
And I reckon it only took me about 2 weeks that you would get halfway through a joke and go, no, that's not the way I think.
Okay.
I don't think that way. I'm a woman who's in her early 30s. I think like that. I write like that. And I was getting better and better at it because then I'd hand the jokes over and the presenter was like, yeah, that's, I relate to that.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, and then you realise, bang, I'm writing for the person. This okay. is great. You then get to listen to your joke come out from the person who yeah. can sell it the way you wrote it.
Yes,
go,
right, okay.
Well, that's fantastic.
Okay.
I like that joke.
Excellent.
You know, I could never do the joke.
Sure.
Because it's not my material. It's written for someone else. So that was interesting. And then I got the bug for radio.
Okay.
I basically got the bug for radio, and I'll be honest with you, because people there were making coin. Heaps okay. of it, you know, especially in breakfast. There was cash all over the place. Pardon me. And then in 2001, January 2001, I was offered a job on the Sunshine Coast, which mm-hmm. is like an hour north of Brisbane,
okay.
on a commercial radio station. At that point was number four in the market, mm-hmm. a station called 91.9 CFM. They put me on a trial period of 3 months, I think, from memory. I sat in the chair, had another an anchor co-host, mm-hmm. JC, John Caruso, and I loved it.
Okay.
I loved every minute of it.
And what was that? I'm not really familiar with Australian breakfast radio, but what was the kind of co-host relationship like? Was that...
It was good, actually.
Okay.
We had a point of difference. And okay. the funny thing is that one of the reasons I got the job was because I had written for Sammy. Mm-hmm. I'd written for a lady on radio, okay. and they wanted me to come in and give a slightly skewed female perspective to the day.
Okay.
So I was an advocate, if you like, for women.
Okay.
My co-host
How
wasn't.
Did women feel about that?
Quite good.
Okay,
Quite
cool.
good. Because
sure.
I would actually let them be the voice.
Yeah,
and
right.
portray
okay.
what they're saying.
Okay.
You know, and I wouldn't always just agree with them carte blanche just to win them over.
Sure.
But on certain topics, I would go, no, hang on.
Okay.
You know, and stop the co-host and go, no, you're not right. And it worked better probably because of him. He was an Italian male.
Okay.
So he had that often over-the-top, gratuitous
sure, I got you.
Male
okay.
persona.
Okay.
And even if you just bring that back to middle line, mm-hmm. you're adverse to what he's saying.
Gotcha.
So, and then if you're middle line, you know, women and men are kind of with you.
Yes, sure.
You know,
okay.
either way, extremes okay. obviously aren't on board with you, but mainstream,
okay.
you've hit the ticket.
Uh-huh.
And I loved it. I loved working in radio. Won an award.
Oh, yes, very exciting.
I was the best newcomer on Australian radio in 2002.
Excellent.
And
okay.
Sacked by the start of 2005.
Were you? Okay, okay. So tell me, were you still doing stand-up at this time?
Absolutely.
Or? Oh, you That's, were throughout. Okay.
That was probably the downfall to my radio career. I never, and I didn't realise this at the time, but I never took the radio career seriously.
Okay.
The reason for that is why I've been hamming up saying I was after the money.
Sure, sure.
I was chasing money and not a passion.
Okay.
Message, kids, don't do that.
Yeah, right.
Money's great, but it's not good for you.
Sure, okay.
you know.
Okay, and so you were doing stand-up and you were you
I was,
kind of full, well, obviously not full-time, but were
no,
you professional? Were you getting paid as a stand-up?
I was, yes, I was.
Okay.
And I was getting more and more traction,
mm-hmm.
but slowly because I was doing breakfast radio. You
mm-hmm.
know, when you get up at 3:45 in the morning, you carry an anvil around
Jesus,
for the rest of the day.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's not easy to get up yeah. on stage at 10 o'clock at night and then finish off a show.
Okay.
So I was still doing stand-up, but basically, so I was a 20-minute support act, pretty solidly.
Okay.
And I was moving into emceeing and hosting shows.
Sure. What was your, just out of interest, because you were doing comedy, because you were doing radio at the time and
yeah.
you were being paid to do
yeah.
radio, presumably, you know, I don't know if you were driving a nice car then, maybe you were.
Yeah.
But
they
how,
got
did
better
the
and better.
How did the comedy how did the comedy community react to that? Were you taken seriously as a comic first and foremost?
Sort of half and half.
Did they sort of feel like here's a radio guy chance?
Yeah. No, I think I was a comic first.
Okay.
But there was a little bit of resentment because I'd found myself an income.
Sure.
And I'd only been in comedy for 3 years.
Sure.
There's a bunch of guys here in Brisbane that have been doing comedy for maybe 5/10 years that
okay.
were not gaining as much momentum.
Okay.
And in reality, but probably because they're holding out for Capital City breakfast spots and not thinking outside the square and going to a regional area that's only
sure.
an hour away.
Sure.
We can still work the market as a comic.
Yeah, okay.
The problem with doing breakfast is, though, that I wasn't focused on writing new material
okay.
or progressing with my routine. I was just kind of treading water.
It's a funny one that when you're doing, I did a daytime warm-up job for
yeah.
about 2 years.
Yeah.
Not every day, but enough days that I felt that when I'd done it, even though it wasn't what I was here for,
mm-hmm.
it had kind of fulfilled my performative fix.
Totally.
It's harder
yeah.
to go out in the evening and seek gigs because
Absolutely.
You feel like, well, I've just done quite a lot performing, so
yeah.
actually I'll,
yeah, you know, breakfast radio is just like that. You
sure.
know, you're talking to 100,000 people every morning. It's pretty easy to get complacent about wanting to do anything else.
Sure.
And it got radio was a bit whirlwindy. You know, I won an award in 2002, which is like my first full year into radio. Mm. Then our station was going from number 4 up to number 3, then up to number 2, and then we went to number 1, which is the first time that station ever went to number 1 under that ownership. In fact, probably since it had started. Just for the record, they've never been number 1 since I left. which is 9 years.
Consider it recorded.
And I think that's because we did what we wanted to do on that show. It wasn't until it went number 1 that suddenly people were like, oh, we've got to make sure we do all the right things.
Yeah,
got to follow the book. You know, when we were number 4, they were like, oh, let the boys sit in the closet and talk about whatever they like. Why does everyone like them? Well, this has got weird.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I think that process must be being repeated as we speak.
Absolutely. Of course it is. You know, people turn their back on you when they don't think you've got any progress or talent or whatever happening for them. But then all of a sudden when they think we might lose something really good, they get panicky. And they got real panicky in the end because we're a 2-male team and the opposition put on a girl for breakfast. They were like, oh, we need a girl for breakfast.
Okay.
They tried to weave in a third person. I'm like, the dynamic is not for a third person in this studio. And then they went, oh, you'll make it difficult. I went, you know what? Yeah, I am.
Yeah, right.
Because you're not doing the right thing.
Okay.
Then they went, oh, well, you're gone.
Okay. Was that a stand-up round? How did that happen?
No, it was underhanded and horrible, basically. They kind of, you know, went around and made up a whole heap of reasons why they could terminate my contract and then presented them to me. And I went, you fucking serious?
Yeah.
They went, oh, yeah. And I went, just sack me then, you fuckers. I took it personally for about 6 months.
Okay.
And then I realised after talking to people and people that I trusted in radio, like the person I mentioned that I wrote for at the very start, Sammy, I went to her and said, Sammy, they sacked me. And she went, don't worry about it. I've been sacked 4 times.
Yeah, right, you know, okay.
And she's a popular presenter. So I took it personally for a while going, why would they do that? Why they just wanted to move on. You know, they wanted a female co-host. Mm-hmm. They got a female co-host. It's a pretty simple process. And now that I'm older and wiser, I see that.
Sure.
You know, people get rid of products out of their shop all the time. They don't have to tell you why.
Yeah, right.
Just put a new product in.
Sure.
You know, it's their shop.
Okay. I mean, there's that thick skin you were talking about. You know, 6 months. So, you know, that seems like a reasonable amount of time to be annoyed.
Yeah.
But equally, if you are used to taking those kind of knocks or, you know, you become aware throughout your career.
What annoyed me the most was the humanity in that and the fact that people had just underhandedly made stuff up to get what they wanted.
Sure.
And I'm a big believer in karma. And I've always just sort of sat back and gone, don't worry, you know, that's all right. Those people that did that, they're not doing well now.
Okay.
I'm doing fine.
Okay.
You know, the general manager that was involved in that was sacked from the company 12 months later, demoted to sales.
Now the look in your eye says, because of a certain email that I sent or falsified.
Not even. But what happens is when you go underhanded and do that sort of stuff, eventually the truth comes out.
Yeah.
Eventually, given time, people forget they were supposed to not say anything about that.
Sure.
And things come out, you know, and then people can start going, hey, what? What do you mean? Hang on a minute. That's not right. And it just all fell apart. It all fell apart for them. And I felt not good about that happening, but I felt justified in that, fucking good. You can't just go around making stuff up about people and have it, you know, help your life. I don't think that's the right way. I don't think they don't owe me anything for making that happen because they pushed me into the career that I have now. Like it was a blessing, really.
Sure.
I wouldn't have made the choice to go full time in comedy on my own.
Okay,
but I was pushed into it.
Then you did. That was when it happened. The moment you got sacked, and you went, "Right, this has got to be it now."
One of the beauties of what they did, and when I say, you know, they were underhanded and made stuff up, that's true, right? Mm. But when you get sacked that way, the industry knows that's how you got sacked. So I couldn't even fish in another pond.
Okay.
Name was tarnished, right?
Yeah.
So and to me, at first, I was like, "Fuck!" They've ruined every opportunity I've had in radio. But slowly over time, I went, I don't want that opportunity.
Okay.
What am I doing? I'm still
it's quite
trying
useful to have those doors closed.
I'm still trying to, you know, find that money. I don't know. What am I doing? Why don't I just do stand up full time? So
can I ask you what it was they said you did? Is this some sort of serious allegation?
No, it was just rubbish. Like, you know, making things difficult in the studio and missing breaks and stuff. But it was this underhanded. Here's one example, right? One day I get called in to the program director's office and they say, oh, look, because they brought in the third person by now, right? So there's two other people in the studio. My anchor is like, oh, you're spending too much time on the computer and not talking on the in the breaks, right? And I'm like, but I produced the show. It was self-produced. So I have to keep all of the topics and all the people running and take all the phones. It's like, okay. So then the program director goes, all right, so we want you to move your computer out to your desk so that it's not in the studio. It's like, oh, all right, no worries. Then in the songs, I'll have to run out, get the info, print what I need, run back in. Here's how underhanded it was. I'm sent out by the anchor. Go and get that stuff for the segment.
Yeah.
He throws the mics open and goes to a break. I'm not there.
Okay, right.
Program director comes and goes, where were you? I had to go out to my computer. Fucking computer again. What is it with you and your computer?
Oh, I'm like, man.
I'm like, well, but...
That's impossible.
What the... And I'm like, why is it? What is this? And I didn't realise at the time what's going on.
Okay,
but then
okay.
When they come and give you all the list of things, like, yeah, and by the, you know, you're on the computer, you missed a break, you're out. I'm like, oh,
yeah, okay.
Kidding.
Okay.
Me. You've been sitting around planning this for months.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, it's those little things that you slowly work out in time and go, hang on a second.
Okay, okay.
I was doing what I was told.
Yeah, right, right, okay. So moving on into your stand-up practice then, you became full-time. As a result of that door was closed or radio.
Grab the horns.
Okay.
The focus then was to write a good headline.
Okay.
Because I was doing the odd headline spot here and there.
And the way it works here, I mean, the only non-festival gig I've ever done in Australia was last night.
Yeah,
And it's a kind of topsy-turvy way to the UK system.
It is. We do it around
the
other way.
Put the open spot on first, which can be problematic or could be great.
Yeah.
And then you've got a newer act and then a break and slightly more established acts than a break. It's more like the American system and then a headline doing 40.
That's right. Yeah. So we go open mic, established semi-pro, professional.
Gotcha.
Pretty much how it runs.
Gotcha.
You guys do it the other way around because your headlines have to scoot to other gigs.
Yeah, that might be it.
You've got four other clubs to get to.
Yeah, right.
So I spent my time refining the material that I did have and trying to find my voice on stage.
Okay.
So this was the point where my character changed altogether.
Okay. So you let go of the persona that you'd established on radio.
Yeah. Let go of that. Was no longer, you know, I think I was doing a lot of topical stuff during working on radio because you're writing jokes for radio every morning. Yeah. Why not run them at night? Sort of overlapping two careers there and getting the best of the cherry. Then when I went full time, I went, you know what, I don't want to be known as, and this is how bad it was. Like I had, you know, still had a routine about farts.
Yeah. Okay.
And I had some impersonation bits and pieces that were really quite gimmicky, you know, Simpsons and South Park and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
I decided I wanted to move away from that.
Okay.
And get out of that. So I wanted to do more story based type comedy.
Mm.
And I was pretty shit at that to start with. But then I got the hang of that and started writing those quite nicely. And probably did that pretty solidly through until maybe 2008, about 2008.
And when you say your persona, you let go of the radio persona, what was different about your radio self to your stage self? Like apart from the material, what was different in your attitude?
I was more mechanical when I was thinking in radio persona. It was a mechanical.
Okay.
You know when you know you have to link A, B, and C together, and you'll get D.
Sure.
I was just doing that. Sure. I wasn't trying out other letters in the middle to see if I could still get back to D.
Okay. I mean, do you mean that in terms of the material you were writing?
No, the style.
Okay.
In the style of what I was writing.
Okay. So what was your, when you were on radio, were you like a sort of happy, cheery guy, or what was the difference in
nonsense
tone?
Observation.
Okay.
And generally sort of lent on innuendo to get a tag. So that was the...
Gotcha.
You know, so morning friendly.
Sorry, I think what I'm trying to say is in not the words you were saying, but your attitude. Were you kind of happy-go-lucky? Were you...
No, not the same as I am now.
Okay.
No, I was more serious.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And that was the problem. It was rigid. That's
because
what I mean
you were
by,
originally trying to do that.
That's what I mean by mechanical.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
So to the point where now, and you've seen me work recently, if someone is distracting or annoying me in the crowd,
mm-hmm.
I don't slay them.
Sure.
I point out to them that they're creating a disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, old me would have told them to shut the fuck up.
Sure.
Got the whole crowd to yell out, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, okay.
You know, that heavy-handed... We've all done it.
Sure.
And we've all seen it done. But it's just ugly. And I didn't want to do that anymore.
Okay.
And I also, the reason I was doing that in the past was it's ironically because I wanted everybody in the crowd to like me.
Okay.
I didn't realise that doesn't happen. You know, at that point, I didn't get that. You know, play to your strength. There's no point trying to impress everybody because there's always going to be someone who just doesn't like what you're doing.
Okay.
For no other reason than it's just not their thing.
Sure.
You know? So once I realised that, I was able to let go of the reins a little bit. And be a bit more comfortable, a bit more fun, a little bit more lighthearted, and therefore more likeable.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. I totally understand that. That's when you stop trying, almost like, and you see that in comics, you see that in newer comics.
Yeah.
The desperation to be liked.
Absolutely.
It's crippling and makes them unlikable.
Yeah. And it probably was a hangover from my childhood. You know, I just wanted to be liked by the group. That was what I was chasing. Turns out when you let go of that, well, people kind of like you.
That's quite weird, isn't it? That's a really weird dynamic. It must be very difficult to explain that to a newer act or to a non-performer.
I'm sure people told me. I'm sure people told me, just don't worry about that. You're like, how can you fucking not worry about
that? Dating. It's like dating. Yeah. My mate was saying the other night, as soon as you get married, everyone's after you because you're unattainable. But, yeah.
It's similar in so many things. Like money. You know, if you really worry about money, there's never enough. Mm. If you stop worrying about money, somehow there just seems to be enough money. Mm. You know, it's a real weird thing that we have to deal with in our lives, and somehow we stop ourselves from progressing.
So just in terms of your, well, let's just sort of finish the journey up until now. So 2007, you did the Edinburgh show.
Yes.
Was that your only time in Edinburgh?
No, that was the second solo show that I'd done in Edinburgh.
Okay.
Good mate of mine, Mickey D, who you know.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
We started in Raw Comedy together. So we were in the national final in 98.
Okay.
Mickey, as you know, shot over to the UK not long after that, like 99, 2000. I think he was working in KFC at Edinburgh, doing comedy on the circuit and popping down to London when he could. And he had shows at the festival from probably 2002, I'd reckon.
Okay.
In 2003, I went to the Edinburgh Festival for the first time with my radio show, doing a live show from the Underbelly back to Australia.
Okay.
My first ever interview was Janie Godley.
No way. That's a hell of a first interview.
And we've been buddies ever since.
Oh,
which,
great.
You know, which is just lovely.
Sure.
And you've got to read her book, Janie Godley. Check it out.
I've not read it, actually. I've met her several times. Yeah, read the book. Lovely. Okay.
So I went, that was the first time. The next year, I went on a bit of a scouts mission without doing the radio, just did some compilation spots, bits and pieces wherever I could. The following year, I went and did Fat Cave with Mickey and a show at the Nickel Edwards, which was like a compilation show.
I remember the Nickel Edwards,
It was an interesting thing. Anyway, and then the following year, I did my first solo show at the Cafe Royal.
Okay.
Over in the new part of town on Princes Street.
Gotcha.
And was a great deal of fun. I loved it. Was nervous and horribly scared. And I'd done a run of Jongleurs shows through London just before that.
Okay.
At Camden.
To prepare you for Edinburgh.
Holy shit. I just thought that would prepare me a little bit for the way English people watch comedy.
Yes,
Jongleurs is not the way English people watch comedy.
Sure.
That was horrible.
I think the way I think about those commercial clubs, Jongleurs and Highlights and stuff like that is... those are people that don't necessarily go to a lot of comedy in the audience. And ultimately, the way you have to think of it is one day they're going to buy your DVD.
There are a bunch of stag and hen nights, you know, back to back to back. I walked out on stage for the first time to this. Bowling Warnie! And it didn't stop. And it wasn't just the same guy.
Yeah,
like, as soon as he finished, another guy, Bowling Warnie!
God.
Bowling Warnie! What the hell are you doing?
Oh, my God.
Because it was right at the height of Warnie being in the paper. So I went to Edinburgh. I had a fun time there. And the reason I went to Edinburgh to do my first festival shows is simply to do them in the hardest place to do a show.
Okay.
I figured a baptism...
I was going to say, what was the theory behind that? But that makes perfect
baptism
sense.
Baptism of fire.
Sure.
Why not? Bite the chunk and really try and do it. Go to a place where absolutely no one knows who you are, no one knows what you do. You've got an opportunity to start a clean slate and punch out a one-hour show. See how you go. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
And it also enables you to make your mistakes away from
home.
Yeah,
and not be panned. Because back here, I mean, if you get panned for your first show, it's a good amount of time before they'll give you another chance, you know. So I did that, and then I kind of had a break because I didn't know how the festivals here in Australia worked. So I went through the same process. I went to Adelaide, did compilation spots. First ever shows I did in Adelaide were the late shows at the Gov.
Okay.
Did them for Mary Tobin. I did two or three spots. First time I went down, I just went for a weekend. Went and had a look at the Rhino and went, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 2010 that I took my own show to Adelaide.
Okay.
And I was at a little venue just out of town called the Maiden Magpie. I don't know if you popped out
there. I don't know.
It's a bit out of town. It was their first year of being a venue and they thought that I'd be a good highlight act.
Okay.
It's a bit out of town, but I thought, that's fine. Suits me down the ground for my first one. Not going to cost me a whole bit of money.
Sure.
If I don't make much, I'll be all right. It's a good way in. Show was really popular. It was a show called Hurry Up Jesus.
Okay.
About religion. And not a slay at religion, but an observation of religion.
Sure.
The show was really popular and I got picked up by the Indianapolis Fringe in America and taken over to the Bible Belt to do this show called Hurry Up Jesus.
Oh, my God, really? How was that?
It was interesting.
Go on. Talk about that. Tell me about that. That's incredible, doing stand-up comedy to a Christian audience.
Pretty much.
Okay.
Christian-friendly audience, I would call them now. I think when I went, I assumed that they were all going to come in with their Bibles and make sure that I didn't say anything bad about God.
Sure.
In hindsight... they quite like other people's opinions.
Okay.
And because I wasn't being derogatory or telling people that believed in God that they were stupid, not just because I don't have a belief doesn't mean I don't believe that other people can.
Yeah,
you know. So that was the through line of my show. 95% of the people loved it. There was a couple of nights where you could see the people in the crowd that had come along because they thought it was going to be an insight to religion, looking at you going, you're going to hell. You know you're going to hell, right? And just sit there not doing anything. not saying anything, not getting into it. But they were just my observations, genuine observations of, you know, of religion. And I had a great deal of fun there. It's a really good place to go and stretch your legs.
What's the difference for you in writing an hour-long show to writing your set, your stand-up?
Right.
Do you approach it differently? Or do you...
Absolutely. Okay. My stand-up routine for club and pub and gigs in general, I don't write.
Okay.
It happens.
Okay.
It just happens. And I don't mean I just make it up every night, but I improv as much as I can. The good improv bits turn into bits that I workshop into proper pieces.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And then I replace the bits that were written before that and improv the tail.
Okay.
Constantly evolving.
Okay.
So I will have a different closer every 6 months.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And that's in a, when you say a headline set over here, that's 40.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's so, practically an Edinburgh show. That's practically an hour long show.
Yeah.
Halfway
basically.
There, more than.
Yeah. But that has taken some time, Stu. And realistically, only the last 3 years have I been improving to the level where I'm quite happy with that.
Okay.
You know, it was hit and miss to start with. When you go into crowd work and the old, what's your name, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
Which is very common, but I think I've turned that into, I don't want to say art form, because that's ridiculous, but I've turned it into my thing.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
I am able...
I described you to someone recently in an email. You're like, you're a power MC. Do you know what I mean? You're like last night, for example, at the gig, it was very quiet to begin with. It's quite an unusual, it's like a commercial club, but on a Thursday night when everyone's got school tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, you know, you really just turned it into a gig. You've got that kind of, you know, you can judge it. And
It's all about... I think in my mind, it's all about having them believe that you want the show to be good.
Yeah.
You know, forcing audiences into having fun doesn't work.
Sure.
You've got to trick them into it.
There we go, quote that. Lovely.
You've got to make them look the other way.
Okay.
And show them some fun.
Okay. Yeah. And is that observation that you make on audiences, that's born of experience rather than theory? That's you being out there every night.
270 gigs a year.
You were saying last night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of time on stage.
We'll come back to that because I want to talk about the experience of being, you know, the Brisbane guy that we talked about before. But let's just, in terms of making the show, so that's how you make sets. And then how do you change when you come to make an Edinburgh show? Do you start with the premise?
When I want to write a festival show, I start with the premise, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly that. And in fact, I probably start with the title first.
Okay.
But that's because you've got a premise in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And next year's show, I'm actually doing a show called What's Your Name, What Do You Do?
Lovely. Okay.
And I'm going to break down.
I should, just for the listener, this year's show was called Chitty Chatty Bullshit.
Chitty Chatty Bullshit.
Which is lovely. Great
stuff. Which is about the way we talk. So I take the premise, I give it a title, and then I write about 3 times more content than you need for a show.
Okay.
And then I trial that content over 6 shows, an hour long, through November and December. I run all of that bit. All of it for the first 3 shows gets a run. Mm-hmm. Then I start refining it, try and work out the order.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully by show 7, it's ready to run.
Okay. And whereabouts? So those are happening in November.
Yeah.
Where are those shows taking place? Are you doing that
at the Paddo?
Okay.
At the Sit Down Comedy Club on a Wednesday night.
Okay.
I hire the room, sell the tickets myself.
Gotcha.
And I think I've done that now for 6 years and it's turned...
So you have like a 6-week run of Wednesdays.
Yeah.
Great.
And I've actually turned that into an establishment now.
Okay.
People just know that I've got Christmas shows and they know that I'm working up a show. I've got a notes, a stand with notes on it. They know that it's not refined.
Great.
People actually get involved in the process of helping me write the shows.
Sure. So by the time you go to Adelaide, it's up and running
and you've
got it ready to go.
Yeah.
What do you do with it then? Do you take it to Melbourne?
Ordinarily, yes.
Okay.
This year I'm not going to Melbourne because they offered me a time slot that I didn't want to struggle in, which is fine with me. It's not like people are like, oh, you're not doing Melbourne. It's like, yeah, it's right. Just skip a year.
Sure.
You know, Olympians don't always go to the Olympics.
Nice, positive thinking.
Have a year off. But I actually prefer the Adelaide Fringe.
Okay.
I prefer the Fringe crowd. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the Melbourne crowd, but I've also established myself in Adelaide, so people know who I am.
Mm.
In Melbourne, I may as well be an up-and-coming comic, which is fine. But when there's so many big-name acts in Melbourne, you're at the bottom end of the ticket.
The difference for people, and I know this is only a thing I've learned in the last couple of years, is that Adelaide, obviously being a fringe, is open access, whereas Melbourne is kind of curated.
It is. It is. So as you can imagine, the top of the pile gets the top of the top of the rooms, the top of the billing, the top of the promotion, and then if you fit in somewhere down along the way, you've just got to sort of push yourself along.
Okay.
And there's 2 ways to go. I mean, you can either be festival produced or produce yourself.
Okay.
And I've never produced myself for Melbourne. I've always done festival produced venues, but I've seen the people that produce themselves, and it's a slog. You know, you're not on any of the blackboards. You're not promoted by the festival. Mm. You still register. It's a weird system. I find it a bit strange. And I'd prefer that it was more like a fringe and open access and just let people do their thing. Because I think when it's controlled and contrived, you kind of end up with what other people want rather than what the industry kind of wants.
Sure. Mm. So something I noticed in Adelaide this year was that I saw a lot of shows which were billed, not which weren't billed as previews, that then turned out to be previews.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of that because people use it as a run-up to Melbourne.
There's two minds to that too, isn't there? Adelaide people are like, why don't you bring your refined show here? Why do we have to see the practice?
Sure.
But then I also think there's a train of thoughts like, oh, well, at least they've come.
True enough, yeah.
Would you rather they didn't turn up? Oh, no, I kind of like them being here.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you start with the premise, you work it up over those Christmas gigs, and then you do the show. So is anything happening with your talking show,
show. What I do then is I do a return season to Brisbane so that the people that helped kind of put it together can see it refined and come off the back of a festival. And especially this year, you know, it was my most successful festival ever in every way you look at it. Numbers, you know, result, kudos, reviews, you know.
You said before that your first hour in Adelaide was 2010.
Yeah,
well, it clearly was a massive year for you because I felt like this must be your 15th year at the festival. Do you know what I mean? You were everywhere. Your show was everywhere. You were everywhere.
Yeah.
Great.
This year was quite incredible. I spend the years learning about Adelaide, going there to do as many spots as you can in as many of the big name lake shows as possible. And this year, I didn't have time to do all of the stuff that people wanted me to do. You know, it's the first time I've ever had to go, oh, I can't do that. Oh, and it just, I mean, that hurt me in a way because it's been my philosophy in the past to do everything. Sure. And I've kind of realised halfway through Adelaide this year that I've become that guy that just does the namey-name late shows, you know?
Okay.
And I went, oh, no, I'm that guy.
Do you mean the namey-name ones? You mean you pick of the offers?
Well, you fill up with them. You know, you end up with things like Fat Cave, great show, well-presented, well-set-up, well-run, well-hosted by Mickey. Mm-hmm. You know, Best of the Fest late shows that are run by Tobin and always have been done in a great way. The Rhino Room late shows, you know, Chopper's late show to like 500 or 600 people.
Yeah.
Marcel Leconte's late show.
Yeah.
You know, and without naming names, there are 25 other late shows that compile the best of this and best of that. And, you know, just didn't even have a chance. You know, it's a great thing.
Yeah.
But then you realise, okay.
Yeah, that's the point though. Surely you want to be being that guy.
I guess so. Yeah, but I guess I kind of also enjoyed being the anywhere guy, you know?
Yeah, okay.
And I guess that now I feel a genuine commitment to those people to say yes. I need to do them because they've helped me get to that point. Like, for example, the first time I ever went to Adelaide, I think I did two nights for Mary, you know, two nights in her room. I think I did four nights this year, plus did the supports for Stephen K. Amos to do his previous show. So it's like six performances on her stage just in the festival.
Yeah.
You know, it's only 5 weekends. So Yeah, it's been interesting. This year was very busy. I won't lie to you, it was hard. It was tricky.
Okay.
Especially, you know, those nights where you have to peel yourself away from everybody having a good time because you've got like radio at 8 a.m. or you've got five shows the next day or you're hosting a 6-hour benefit for Queensland at some outdoor gig. Jesus, who said yes to that?
Talking of long shows, you are or were a record holder?
I was a record holder. Yeah, Guinness World Record for the longest ever show by an individual.
Okay.
I did 38 hours and 6 minutes on stage.
When was that?
2009, October 2009.
And what prompted that? Where did that idea come from? You must have talked about this at length, obviously, when it went off. So
what prompted it's not a question that everybody asks. I wanted to give something back.
Mm-hmm.
I felt in 2009 that I'd been given a lot of opportunities already, and that's with discounting the last 2 or 3 years of what I've been allowed to do. I was grateful at the fact that I was full-time. You know, I went full-time in 2000 and... What was it, five? The start of 2005. And by the end of 2009, I'd successfully had, a CD produced and sold. I'd just made a DVD. And I was looking to do something good, you know, to acknowledge that I'm grateful for what I have, right, for whatever reason. So I decided to try and have a shot at the longest ever show for two reasons. One, I was present at Mark Watson's 24-hour show 3 times in Edinburgh and just thought it was brilliant. Sure. I really enjoyed it. Two, I spoke to Mark Watson, told him I was really keen to break the Guinness World Record, which was 36 hours set by Tommy Tiernan and out of Ireland. And Mark Watson said, use my format. Go for it. I give you my blessing.
Mm-hmm.
You're a great dude. You've been there. Have a go.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. I had a chop. And the reason I did it, secondly, was for charity.
Mm-hmm.
And given what we talked about earlier, I chose my charity was the Abused Children's Trust.
Mm.
And it was a proper charity thing. It wasn't like I was giving a percentage of the tickets to them. They were taking the door.
Sure.
The whole event cost me $7,000 to put on.
Okay.
I paid that.
Yeah.
And had all of the profit go to the charity.
Okay.
I didn't want to make money out of it. The whole idea was giving something back.
Sure.
Trying to pass it forward. And it ended up being bigger and better than I could have imagined. It was in the main theatre at the Gallery of Modern Art. So I was an installation for a weekend. I made it past the 36-hour record point to set a new record for Guinness.
Okay.
Had a whole bunch of people.
And this is, I mean, this isn't like, or the way it's been described to me, this is just you on stage doing comedy.
I was on stage the entire time, but I had some guests join me.
Okay.
But I never was gone.
Sure.
Like, it's not like I was hosting the show.
Sure.
And bringing them on.
And how different to Mark Watson's kind of version of it? Because he has a lot of, he's got lots of people on. He's definitely always on stage, but he's not really doing material. He's sending people on missions and
There was a bit of that.
Okay.
Mickey D was my producer.
Mm-hmm.
So he was with me most of the time, apart from when he was asleep.
Okay.
And I had an IT person constantly on stage. So we were doing back and forth online.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of YouTube stuff. And like Jason Cook from the UK filmed himself at a bunch of clubs in Liverpool and cut up a video and sent it down.
Lovely.
He's trying to get me to do it again so that he can do the start via YouTube and fly over and be here for the end.
Oh, man, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's great.
And if his show keeps going the way it is, I might have to do it.
Yeah, right.
Because it'll probably be part of the show.
Excellent.
So that was a great deal of fun. It nearly killed me. And I was sore.
Were there bits of it you didn't enjoy? Were there bits of it where you thought, what the hell am I doing?
Sort of like that 8-9 hour mark.
Sure.
Where a little voice in your head going, just piss off. No one will blame you.
Yeah.
No one will judge you for life. And then the other voice goes, do you ever imagine if you finish this?
Yeah, right. Okay.
And that little voice was just enough to.
And besides the charity aspect of it, did that lead to, I mean, that must have been good for your profile over here.
You know what?
Did it make much of a difference or anything?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It was a weird one. Like, I got TV coverage out of it and they crossed to me on the news and different bits and pieces, but I think people kind of saw it for what I wanted it to be seen as, and it was just a gesture. You know, it wasn't supposed to get me overnight popularity or win me any votes with the public. It was just a gesture of giving something back and having a slog at, you know, testing myself, which I love doing. I just hosted two shows at once down in Adelaide.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, I saw that on the Rhino. You hosted both the upstairs and the downstairs in the Rhino.
At the same time.
And where did that idea come from? Did you just
me.
Think...
Yeah. Three years ago,
I reckon I can do this.
I said to Craig Egan, imagine if someone hosted the upstairs and the downstairs show at the same time. He went, it can't happen. I went, I reckon I could do it. Shut up. You couldn't do it. The next year, wouldn't it be great if someone, shut up. It's not happening. All right. Third year, wouldn't it be great if, all right. Hey?
Great.
I can do it? Yeah, all right.
And how was that? How did that go?
It was great. Okay. I loved it.
I mean, there must have been a sense with both rooms must have known what was going
obviously,
on.
Obviously, I set it up with them so that they knew what was going on. It was imperative that the acts that were on paid attention to the cues.
Sure.
If I came back in the room, it was time for them to wrap up and finish.
Gotcha.
But it wasn't like I came and had to cut anyone off either. It was natural finishing anyway. It was all quite good. The hard part, which I didn't factor in, was that up and down, I had to go up and down the stairs 18 times.
Sure.
Hosting two shows, I ended up doing 64 minutes on stage.
Okay.
Throwing to four breaks and introducing 14 acts. So I didn't do all the math beforehand.
Yeah, sure. And I know how your brain works. You're already thinking, and if we had another gig in the courtyard at the
moment. Hey, I did actually say.
Yeah, of course you did.
I suggested that the beer garden could have a three-man show with just one break.
Oh,
like,
man.
Fit it in.
Chuck that in as well.
Next year.
So let's talk then, and we're close to wrapping up, but there's two more things I want to talk about. One is this idea of you being the guy in Brisbane. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this last night.
Yeah.
I know there's certain areas of the UK that have particular people in them who are like, I'm the guy, I run all of these shows, I do the radio show, I do this, I do that.
Yeah.
And you have a similar thing in Brisbane. There are, how many other people are there of your kind of profile or your work rate in Queensland?
Profile-wise... realistically, probably only Mel Buttle.
Okay.
Who do you know Mel Buttle?
I don't know Mel.
Right. Well, she's got a good profile because she does a lot of stuff on Triple J.
Mm-hmm.
She writes a very good comedy and she's prolific with putting on shows.
Sure.
But she's a newer comic. She's really only been on the scene for probably 6 or 7 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Could be wrong. Could be longer. Mm-hmm. But in terms of full-time touring acts in Brisbane, there just isn't. There's been some that have moved off and moved on, like names you'll know, like Bart Freebane,
mm-hmm.
Harley Breen.
Okay.
They've started here. Josh Thomas.
Moved to Melbourne.
Melbourne,
Sydney. Everyone moves to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess I'm just the guy that stayed.
Sure. Okay. And why, so and why is that? Why do you think? Did you, there must have been a point where you thought, I'm going to go to Melbourne.
I like it here. Okay. There's actually been never a point where I'm like, oh, I'll move to Melbourne. I always believed you could get to the level where it doesn't matter where you are. Mm-hmm. If you're needed, you just go there.
Mm-hmm.
It's really only a 1 or 2 hour flight. I mean, If you live in London and work as a comic, you might have a 4 hour drive.
Yeah,
you know? It's not that hard to fly to another cap city. And I never really understood why you needed to live there just to work there. I work in all those places.
Yeah.
I just get to live here. And I like the scene here. I've watched the scene here grow. I want to stay a part of it and keep it vibrant and try and keep the ethos that was given to me by the guys that were at the top when I started to the younger comics and keep it growing. And I'd love it to be bigger.
You were saying it would actually be, it's in your interest if there was another guy that was the Brisbane guy.
Yeah, it'd be great if there was four more.
Sure.
You know, it would give the whole scene more kudos because realistically, and especially when I first started back in the 90s, people were like, oh yes, all the good comics are from Sydney and Melbourne, eh?
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't gone away. Yeah. That still lives. You know, the fact that when I go to festivals, the most common question, people, are you from Sydney or Melbourne, mate?
Mm.
So, yeah, I'm from Brisbane. People go, oh, yeah, all right. They have comedy, do they?
Yeah, exactly. I was talking to my friend Nick Hopkins last night. He's was based in the UK, lives in Brisbane.
Yeah.
He's a TV producer, he's got quite a high level.
Yeah.
And he said it's so frustrating because he has the same thing. There's not the money for it.
It's incredible.
Brisbane just doesn't have yet that kind of focus, that profile, is it?
But I think it's coming. You know, I think it's growing. It's becoming more popular. In terms of population, it's grown heaps. You know, there's like 1,000 people a week move to southeast Queensland or something. It's quite helpful. But it's getting there. You know, it's got such a stable scene too. I think it's in some ways stronger than the southern states. It just doesn't have the kudos. It's kind of like the Galapagos Islands of comedy. You know, we've evolved without anyone else noticing.
Sure. Okay. Well, listen, I'm aware that you've got to get some lunch during your lunch break before you go back to the kids. If we could just have 5 more minutes.
Yeah, mate.
What I wanted to ask was, from your perspective, there's a thing that's very common in the UK and I'm sure everywhere where there's comedians that I've certainly experienced myself, of you start off feeling like there's a ladder, a career progression, and then you notice that it's not actually a ladder and there's people leapfrogging you and streaking ahead of you.
Yeah.
As someone who's done spots in TV but not got their own TV vehicle, which I feel like a lot of guys here have. I guess there's quite a lot of TV to be made and not so many acts as in the UK. And something I was talking to Fideli about, who I'm hopefully going to interview on this podcast next week, was that in the UK, I feel like there's lots of barriers towards success.
Yeah.
Whereas over here, I feel like the whole idiom of the comedy industry is we need more acts, we need more people. How can we help each other? Yeah, how can we get bigger? So what I was going to ask was, from your point of view, how do you cope emotionally, how do you cope mentally? How do you stay positive when you see people that you must have given gigs to streaking ahead and getting their own series?
There's two answers to that. My first answer is I'm quite ambitious for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also ambitious for other people. If other people have success, I'm really happy with that. It's often a good thing. And like I said before, it'd be better if more people in Brisbane had success because it would give us more of a pin on the map.
Yeah.
So when, let's use Josh Thomas as an example, who came up from Brisbane, got fantastic coverage, killed it at the festival and got onto television.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, who don't need naming, were you know, jealous, angry, cross, thinking that he didn't deserve any of that. I look at it from a different perspective. The things that Josh is doing on television are fantastic. They're all great roles, but they're not roles I would ever have gotten.
Sure.
If Josh Thomas didn't exist, I wouldn't have that job.
Sure.
Someone else would. You have to look at that realistically. You know, every TV producer and every TV, you know, director is looking for something specific. If they're picking someone like Josh Thomas, they're not looking for me.
Sure.
You know, they're not looking for my type of person or my type of act. It's not just because Josh is a funny comic.
Mm-hmm.
It's because he's a good vehicle for what they want in a show.
Okay.
You know, and that's just one example. And I look at it always like that. I look at the person that got the position and think, well, I don't fit the cast.
Okay.
You know, I've been to castings as an actor and no one looking at the form going,
that's not me.
They're not looking for me.
Sure.
I'm just here because I might be.
Sure.
You know? So I think that focusing on what I want and what I'm looking to achieve is keeping me going.
Okay.
You know, if you look at everyone else and start judging yourself against them,
sure.
You never do that properly. You never know why they've got what they've got or what they want to do with what they've got or where they want to go with what they're doing. You know, you've just got to focus on your own direction.
But is there a part of you going, well, what's the thing that I get cast for?
No, I've stopped.
Okay, yeah. So you did yeah. feel like that for a while.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. But you know what? I'm just comfortable doing what I'm doing. Mm. People often ask me, oh, don't you want to be on telly? I'm like, you know what? If I could just continue doing what I'm doing, making adequate money, doing something that I love for the rest of my career.
It's golden, isn't it? Yeah, it's so hard.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, absolutely. The reason I ask, and I ask a lot of comics that, is obviously there's far fewer famous comics than there are comics.
Sure.
And everyone has to come to some sort of appreciation of, okay, you know, given that we all started thinking, oh my God, I'm doing this now, chances are, what, 5 years max?
I'll be the guy.
Yeah, exactly. And we've all got to come to some understanding of where we fit into it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what keeps that fresh for me is that, like I said, it's only really been 2 or 3 years that I'm comfortable with who I am on stage.
Sure.
So really, it's like I'm just a 3-year-old comic. You know, if you look at every chunk that you achieve as a new beginning, then you really aren't that far behind.
The very last thing I want to say is, you can't mean that. That's so positive. What is it about Australia? What is it about you? Everyone I know who'll be listening to this is going, yeah, okay, well, that's the sort of thing you'd write on a motivational poster with a dolphin. But you can't mean that. You mean that.
I do mean that. You know, I'm really happy. I'm really happy doing what I do. I get amazing opportunities. I get to go to awesome festivals and work with fantastic comics who accept me for who I am. You know, I'm not trying to pretend to be something else or push my way or force my way up. Quite happy to just keep going. A bit tired, but happy.
Thank you very much, Lizzie.
My pleasure. Thanks
a lot.
Thanks, Stu.
So that was Lindsay, who spent his whole lunch hour talking to me in between training up a generation of tomorrow's stand-ups at a thing called Class Clowns that they run out of Melbourne, before then comparing all night at Brisbane's excellent sit-down comedy club. So an incredibly hard worker, fascinating bloke. And I did on your behalf, I gave it my absolute best shot to crack him, but it turns out he just is that positive. He really is that optimistic and happy. How aggravating. Some unique insight into cabaret comedy next week with Clark McFarlane. That's all from me. Thanks to everybody as usual, and I'll speak to you soon. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.